someone will ask, dot, dot, dot. And that could sound like he's predicting questions which the Corinthians are going to ask, and he's kind of trying to preempt them. But I don't think that is the case. I think he knows that they are asking these questions, that in fact, these questions are very much at the heart of their denial of future resurrection. So that's the questions in verse 35. And then in the rest of the passage, he basically just addresses those questions that he knows the Corinthians are asking. And he does so by means of a sandwich. So if you take a quick look at verses 36 to 38, they're all about seed being sown. And then if you jump to verses 42 and 43, they too pick up that same language, don't they, of seed being sown. So those are the two slices of bread, if you like, which you have on the outside of a sandwich, verses 36 to 38, and then verses 42 and 43. But of course, every sandwich also has something in the middle. It has a filling, and in this case then, verses 39 to 41 are the filling in the middle of Paul's sandwich. And so what we're going to do this morning is we're going to look, first of all, at the slices of bread, and then secondly, we're going to look at the filling in the middle, and we're going to do so using two headings. And first of all, a mockery that's silly. A mockery that's silly. Let's go back for a moment to those questions then in verse 35. And I don't think that we're really dealing here actually with two separate questions. Rather, the second question clarifies exactly what is meant by the first. So it's, how are the dead raised? That is, with what kind of body do they come? So we're really dealing with a single question that's about the form of the resurrection body, the form that the resurrection body takes, which could, of course, in theory, be a very reasonable and innocent question, a kind of question that you and I might ask ourselves. I wonder what the resurrection body will be like. I wonder what sort of properties it will have. That's a perfectly good and wholesome question to ask. But you see, on the lips of these Corinthian believers, it's not a reasonable and an innocent question at all. It's a mocking question. We know quite a bit about the city of Corinth in New Testament times. We know about its buildings, and we know that one of the focal buildings in Corinth was the temple of Asclepius, the god of healing. According to one scholar, apart from the temple of Epaphrodite, it was the most visited and popular temple in town. And archaeological research in Corinth has unearthed all these terracotta models of body parts, feet, hands, legs, arms, you name it. What were these for? Well, these were offerings which Corinthian folk would bring to the temple of Asclepius. So someone had a crippled foot. What did he do? Well, he either made or purchased one of these models of a foot, and he took it along to the temple of this god and offered it in the hope of receiving healing. So the prominence then of that particular temple and those particular offerings indicate that Corinth was a city that had its fair share of health problems. Its culture of overindulgence and sexual hedonism probably played a part in that. And of course, we also know, don't we, that the church in Corinth had its fair share of health problems. Paul has to say to them in chapter 11, verse 30 of this epistle, many of you are weak and ill. And against that backdrop then, these Corinthian believers are contemptuous of Paul's belief in resurrection. And so here's one of them. And he's saying, all right, Paul, so I'm going to be raised, am I? My body is going to be raised from the dead, is it? Okay, Paul, so when I get my body back, will I have this chronic back pain? Or will it just be the sight loss in one eye? And then there's another saying, okay, Paul, so my resurrection body then, will it be afflicted by these horrible rashes that I get all the time, or perhaps just the water retention in my ankles? That's the kind of thing that they're getting at. With what kind of body do they come? They have in mind this grotesque image of heaven populated by invalids. And you can almost hear their sniggers then as they direct this question at Paul. Wow, this is going to be great fun, Paul. This eternity that you're describing to us. Having our bodies forever and ever and ever. These decrepit, dilapidated bodies of ours. I hope there'll be plenty of hospitals in heaven. Hope the pharmacists are well stocked. I hope that the disabled access is up to scratch. I'm saying this is not a serious theological question that they're asking in verse 35. It's an insincere, mocking question. Which is why Paul responds with such bite in verse 36. You foolish person, he says. You foolish person. And he then proceeds to demonstrate in the two slices of bread in verses 36 to 38 and 42 and 43 that it's not his belief in resurrection that's silly. Rather, it's their mockery that's silly. They're completely misrepresenting what he means by resurrection. And notice his next three words then after "you foolish person" are "what you sow." What you sow. Now, that could appear a bit odd. What's Paul on about here, you might think? What convoluted argument is he now starting to concoct? Why is he suddenly veering off into the realm of crops and harvest? But actually, of course, he's not suddenly veering off here, is he? He's been in the realm of crops and harvest very recently. Remember back in verses 20 to 23. Remember how by using that term first fruits, he referred there to the resurrection of the dead as a crop, as a harvest. And remember we said actually that reference to the resurrection of the dead as a harvest, it's more than merely a metaphor. It's not merely that the resurrection of the dead is being pictured as a harvest. The resurrection of the dead actually is a harvest. In death, our bodies go into the ground, and on resurrection day, they will come out of the ground. So that resurrection will be, if you like, the first harvest of that new creation. And so Paul is simply picking up the language now in verse 36 that he'd used earlier in that description of resurrection. He's picking up this harvest language from earlier in the chapter. And his point here is this. In a harvest, is there ever a close resemblance between what goes into the ground and what several months later comes out of the ground? Well, no, of course there isn't, is there? Verse 37. What you sow is not the body that is to be. He's talking about in normal harvest now. What you sow is not the body that is to be, but a bare seed, perhaps of wheat or of some other grain. Now, of course, it is the thing that is put into the ground that comes out again at harvest. It's not like these cookery programs on television where you see all the ingredients being put into the dish and then the dish goes into the oven. But then, of course, at that point, the presenter conveniently produces one that he has made earlier. So that there's no direct continuity between the dish that you've seen him kind of make and the dish that you then see him cutting up and tasting. It's not like that. In a harvest, there is direct continuity, isn't there? Between what goes into the ground and what comes out again. It's the same thing, occupying the same spot in the same field. But the point is, its form has changed completely. So that hardly anything of the wheat in its ripe, fully grown form was observable at the point when the seed was placed in the ground. And Paul is saying what is true then of every annual agricultural harvest is also true of the great climactic resurrection harvest. So it is, verse 42, with the resurrection of the dead. in that harvest too. It's the same thing that's put into the ground that comes out again. It's these bodies. But in that harvest too, the form will be changed completely, so that hardly anything of the body in its future resurrected state is yet observable in its present state. And that's why the Corinthians' mockery is silly. They are presupposing a close resemblance between the body in its present state and the body in its future resurrected state. And that, of course, would be undesirable. We certainly don't want our bodies back as they are now. But that idea is ludicrous. Paul is saying that's not how harvests work. Even the most agriculturally unaware Corinthian church member ought to know that's not how harvests work. Harvests don't just involve transition, a seed transitioning from the sowing phase to the reaping phase. Harvests involve transformation, the seed being transformed so that it's almost beyond recognition. And the resurrection of the body is a harvest. So the body doesn't just transition from one world to the next. No, the body at the resurrection is transformed again, almost beyond recognition. And notice indeed Paul goes further then. And if you'll excuse the pun, he fleshes out that transformation. And he mentions in verses 42 and 43 three ways in which the resurrection body will be a transformed body. So first of all, it will be transformed in its prospects. It will be transformed in its prospects. The body in its present state, Paul says, is perishable. Perishable. In other words, however your body might be doing right now, this morning, whatever condition it might be in, the reality is its prospects are grim. Your body, to put it bluntly, is on the way out. It's wearing down. It's on a downward trajectory which nothing in this world can possibly halt. There's been this chap, hasn't there, in the news this past week or so. He wants to legally change his age, bringing it down by 20 years or something. From 69 to 49, I think it is. Now, I don't know what the man's motive is. I haven't really looked into the story. And if it's a deliberate satire on his part to expose the madness of allowing personal preferences to trump biological facts, which of course some do in the realm of gender, then I guess it's quite a clever thing for him to do. But if, on the other hand, the guy is himself genuinely trying to override biological facts with his own personal preferences, then he's mad, isn't he? Because lowering his legal age won't somehow alter the degenerative process that is going on in his body, any more than King Canute's efforts altered the incoming tide. No, our bodies in their present state are perishable. Their prospects are grim. But, Paul says, that won't be the case anymore in their resurrected state. Resurrection will transform our bodies into imperishable things. See, it's not like a game of basketball. So in a game of basketball, you have the first quarter, and it's 10 minutes, and everyone can see the clock running down and running down and running down until it gets to zero, and then there's a break when they have all the silly cheerleaders and all that kind of stuff, and then the clock is reset to 10 minutes again, and there's a second quarter where the whole process is repeated, and then again for a third quarter, and then again for one more. On Resurrection Day, our bodies won't simply be reset so that they can start running down again, just like they did before. No, there'll be no more running down. No more aging. No more depreciation over time. Indeed, Donald MacLeod suggests that the trajectory may well be in the other direction. He says, in all probability, the body will continue to develop positively and will maybe do so infinitely, not in its quantity, but in its competence. Imagine that. For all eternity, our bodies improving and moving upwards to higher and higher levels of competence and performance. Paul was very conscious, wasn't he, of the body's present degeneration. Not surprising, I suppose, considering how much he suffered. He often mentions it. And in some places then he contrasts that bodily degeneration with what is presently going on in our souls as believers. Think of 2 Corinthians 4:16. Therefore we do not lose heart, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. Or Romans 8:10, where he says, but if Christ is in you, the body is dead because of sin. That's a pretty brutal description, isn't it? He's not saying that the body will be dead once you die, but the body is dead now. It's dying. It's in a state of death. The body is dead because of sin. Yeah, the spirit, capital S, I think, is life because of righteousness. The spirit has imparted life within you. So often that's how Paul's contrast works. He contrasts what's presently going on with our bodies with what's presently going on with our souls. But here it's a different contrast then. Not what's presently going on with our bodies contrasted with what's presently going on with our souls, but what's presently going on with our bodies contrasted with our bodies in their future resurrected states. When they won't be wasting away anymore. Their condition will then match the condition of our souls. They too will be renewed day by day. Their prospects are glorious. And so that's the first transformation he spells out. The body will be transformed in its prospects, but then secondly, it'll be transformed in its dignity. Transformed in its dignity. The body in its present state, Paul says, is marked by dishonor. In other words, it has little dignity. It has little dignity. It's interesting, actually, that in verse 37, he refers there to the seed. He's talking about normal harvest. And he refers to the seed, doesn't he, in its kind of pre-sowing state as a bare seed. A bare seed. It's the Greek word naked. A naked seed. And it's the idea there then that in harvest, God clothes the seed. It goes into the ground naked and then God in the harvest clothes it. Which is a concept Paul uses elsewhere of resurrection. We sang just now, didn't we, from 2 Corinthians chapter 5. And it's interesting that in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul uses this language of nakedness and clothing for the body in its present state versus the body at the resurrection. He says, in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened, not that we will be unclothed, but that we will be further clothed. And he's saying there then that in our present state, our present bodily state, it's like we are naked, and at the resurrection it's like we shall be clothed. What does he mean by that? Well, of course, nakedness throughout Scripture is so often associated with shame, isn't it? And indignity. And Paul's point is then that our bodies in their present state are so shameful, so lacking in dignity. But then they will be clothed, they will be glorious in the resurrection. On resurrection day, the indignity will disappear. You think of how Jesus puts it in Matthew 13:43. He talks about the righteous shining like the sun in the kingdom of the Father. The righteous shining like the sun. Perhaps a little hint of bodily, outward splendor and dignity. I quoted at our members' meeting the other night, C.S. Lewis, there in his essay, The Weight of Glory. And he effectively says there that, you know, you think of the believer that you're sitting next to this morning. And if you could right now suddenly see that believer in their resurrected form, if they just in this moment suddenly experienced their resurrection, their glorification, you could see them now in that form, you would be tempted to worship that person. That's what Lewis says. Such is the radiance and the glory and the beauty. And the body then, in its resurrection form, will be transformed in that way. There won't be any TV programs in the new world called Embarrassing Bodies. There won't be any such possibility of body shaming. No, they will be glorious. So the body transformed then in its prospects, in its dignity, and then thirdly in its health. It will be transformed in its health. The body in its present state, Paul says, is marked by weakness. In other words, its health is poor. I've already said that this would have been a particular relevance to those Corinthians in their city and in their church where there was so much poor health. But of course, it's relevant for all of us, isn't it? We live in a context of such vulnerability to poor health, to injury and accident. Fraser and I were at a football match last week. Paul was there as well. And at one point, a player was running up to take a free kick. And before he even kicked the ball in the free kick, he collapsed, clutching his knee. The game had to be stopped for almost 10 minutes. A stretcher had to come on. The guy had to get oxygen. No contact with another player. Just gone down like that. And this is a Premier League footballer. Super fit compared to most of us. But we're so vulnerable, aren't we, to injury and illness. You know, if you have children, one of the children picks up some bug at school. And they come home and, you know, inevitably the middle of the night comes and they start being sick. And then, you know, a few hours later another sibling goes down with it. And then another sibling. And as parents, you're almost planning, oh yeah, I'll get it on Thursday. And I have to take a day off work then. And it's crazy, isn't it? Just because one child has spent a bit too much time with Johnny or Jane in the school playground who's a bit sickly, this kind of tidal wave of a bug hits your home and leaves this trail of devastation for a week or so. That's how weak we are. That's how vulnerable, susceptible we are. But in the resurrection, we'll be transformed. And Paul says our bodies then will be powerful. Powerful. They say that cockroaches are the only creature that can withstand, would be able to withstand a global nuclear disaster. Well, our bodies in their resurrection form will be able to withstand a nuclear disaster. But of course, cockroaches don't have the glory to go with it. You wouldn't want a body that was as ugly as a cockroach's. But we shall have both the glory and the power, the best of both worlds. See, these preachers who say, you know, Jesus has secured victory over illness, so come up to the front and be healed of your illness or your disability. They're right in the first bit of that sentence, aren't they? Jesus has secured victory over illness and disability. Where they're wrong is in the chronology. They think that we should experience that now, whereas Paul is saying here, we shall experience it then, on Resurrection Day. But they're right in the basic principle that Jesus has secured victory over physical illness and injury. And on Resurrection Day, we shall experience that to its full. And so I hope you see then what Paul is saying here. The Corinthians' mockery is silly. Here they are saying, bodies poor, bodies lasting forever, why would we want that? And Paul is saying, look, you're overlooking this basic fact that resurrection involves transformation. It's not our bodies in their present state that we shall inherit forevermore. It's our bodies in a new, transformed state with new prospects, new dignity, new health. And let's make sure we're clear on that this morning. And let's make sure that we're excited by that this morning. Few people have put it better, have they, than Margaret Clarkson in that hymn that we sometimes sing about the resurrection body. And this verse in particular, O resurrection body, young, radiant, vibrant, free, with powers unthought and dreamed of, how rich your joy shall be. Through endless years to marvel, design, create, explore, in resurrection wonder, to worship, serve, adore. A mockery that's silly. But then secondly, notice with me, a makeup that's suitable. A makeup that's suitable. And here we're moving then to the middle of the sandwich, verses 39 to 41. And by makeup, I'm not talking about the stuff that women put on their faces. I mean what something is made of. Makeup in that sense. And notice then that Paul really is saying in these verses, verses 39 to 41, that all created things, they have a physical makeup that is suitable to their type of existence. And so we have these little lists, don't we, that he gives us here of some created things. We have a list in verse 39, humans, animals, birds and fish, and then we have another list in verse 41, sun, moon and stars. And he's saying then that every created thing has its own makeup that is suitable for its type of existence. Now, he doesn't patronize us. He largely leaves us to fill in the gaps, to fill in the different types of existence that necessitate these different constitutions, these different makeups. So the fact then that fish exist in water and so need a particular makeup, and birds exist in the air and so need a particular makeup, the fact that the sun exists as a life-sustaining energy source and so needs its own makeup, and the moon exists as a light-reflecting satellite and so needs its own particular makeup, and so on. He doesn't go into all those details, but he's assuming that we can see that as we read these lists. But he does flag up here the most basic distinction then that he sees within the creation, the most basic distinction between two different types of existence, and that is earthly existence and heavenly existence. So verse 39, all those creatures, they are earthly, humans, animals, birds and fish. They all exist on earth, that is. And then the ones in verse 41, sun, moon and stars, they of course all exist in heaven, in beyond our planet, in space, whatever language you want to use. And so while yes, every type of created thing is a bit different from all others to suit its own existence. In particular, you can see at this level that all earthly things have a makeup that suits being on earth, and all heavenly things have a makeup that suits being in heaven. I mean, it wouldn't do for me to be made of the stuff that the moon's made of, and the moon to be made of the stuff that I'm made of. Or, you know, any of these, you can't interchange them, because earthly things have to have a makeup that's suitable for earth, and heavenly things a makeup that's suitable for heaven. Now, what's Paul's point here? Why is he talking about this? Well, he does something here in 1 Corinthians 15 that's quite subtle, and I want you to look carefully to see that he does this. Look ahead to verses 47 to 49. It's outside of this morning's passage, but just look ahead to verses 47 to 49, and you'll notice that he again there uses the language of earth and heaven. So he uses the language of earth and heaven here in verses 39 to 41, but he again uses the language of earth and heaven in verses 47 to 49, but with a different meaning. So, in verses 39 to 41, Earth is our planet, and heaven is space, everything beyond our planet. In verses 47 to 49, on the other hand, Earth is the whole creation in its old form, whereas heaven is the whole creation in its new form in the future. So when Paul says that we are of heaven in verse 48, he doesn't mean that we're of heaven in the same way the sun, moon and stars are of heaven, that we are kind of astral beings. He means we're of heaven in the sense that we are going to inherit the new world, the world in its new form. But you see, Paul is saying that the underlying principle is the same. So remember, we said then that earthly creatures, that is, creatures that are of this planet, need a physical makeup that suits that. Heavenly creatures, that is, creatures that are in space, need a makeup that suits that. Well, it's the same if you change the meaning of earth and heaven. And so, earthly creatures, in the sense of people who belong to this whole creation now, need a particular makeup that suits that. On the other hand, those who will belong to heaven, that is the whole creation in the future, need a makeup that's suitable to that. And his point is then that if we were just to get our bodies back, our earthly bodies back, when we are in that new heavenly realm, it just wouldn't be suitable. It'd be ridiculous. It wouldn't work. Some of you may remember when we rebuilt this building, and we weren't sure at one point whether we were going to have enough money to buy new chairs. In the end, of course, we did, but we weren't sure. And so we considered just kind of taking the chairs from Greystone and putting them in this building. Now, some of you remember, they were pretty tatty chairs. There were these old brown things that were a bit worse for wear, and it would have looked fairly ridiculous, these old chairs in a brand new building, and we're very thankful that we were able to get new ones instead. But on a vastly greater scale, then, Paul is saying that our bodies in their earthly form, in the way that they are now, they would just be completely out of place. They would be ridiculous in that new world. It just wouldn't work. It would be unsuitable. It would be inappropriate. Certainly, our bodies in their fallen state would be utterly, utterly, utterly out of place in that new world. But I think he's even saying, and we'll perhaps explore this further next week, that even our bodies, if they had never fallen in the way that Adam and Eve had them, even they wouldn't be suitable for that new world that lies ahead. C.S. Lewis captures something of this, doesn't he, in The Great Divorce. And some of you, if you've read that, you'll remember how the narrator, he is able to go to that new world and get a glimpse of it. And of course, he is still in his this worldly form, physically. And he goes to the new world, and there are these blades of grass that he just can't shift. He can't bend a blade of grass. It's just so strong, so robust in the new world. And Lewis's point is then that world to come, it will be just so much solider, so much grander, that we would be, in our present form, just completely unable to exist there. And that's what Paul is getting at here. You need a makeup that's suitable to the realm in which you exist. And our bodies now, even if they were unfallen, just would not be suitable for that grand new world that God is going to bring about. And I just want to close then by just pausing on the bigness of Paul's vision here. The bigness of Paul's gospel. Paul is taking us here to places that I have a feeling we don't often go, do we, in our evangelical Christianity. Taking us to these mind-bending situations of the world being transformed, and our bodies having to be remade to fit in a transformed world. And it's just so massive and so glorious. And I want to challenge you then to think on these things, to go to 1 Corinthians 15 often, to get the dimensions of Paul's gospel into your thinking. I just want to close quoting from Ted Donnelly, who talks about this, who talks about the bigness of Paul's vision of the gospel. And he says this, he says, "Is this what the world is hearing from the Christian church? Karl Marx had an awe-inspiring vision. a new society, a new world. Millions died for it. Islam has a strong ideology, all of life in submission to Allah. Too often, he says, Christianity is seen simply as silly. Now we know, he continues, that the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. But this is how Donnelly puts it, and I like the way he puts it. He says, but what size of folly is it? Is it little folly, or is it big folly? I would say to you, let it be vast folly. If people are going to reject it, let them not reject it as trivial, silly nonsense, but as madness on a grand scale. And he's talking particularly to preachers here. He says, let us not be seen as little men, peddling effeminate irrelevancies on the fringes of life. Let us try to compel the admission from those who hear us. I don't believe what that man says, but he's talking seriously about big issues on a big scale. That's 1 Corinthians 15, isn't it? Paul is talking about big issues on a big scale, an almost unimaginably big scale. Let's get that into our thinking and have a Christianity that can compete with the well-thought worldviews of our age. A Christianity that stretches to a new world and to new bodies with new facilities and new capabilities and capacities. Let's get the bigness of this into our thinking. And may the world be forced to ask us, what is the reason for the hope that is in you? Amen. Well, let's close singing from Sing Psalms. And we're actually, you'll see from the board, it's Psalm 72, but it's in the appendix to Sing Psalms, so you may not even be aware. At the end of the book, there is an appendix.